I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's January 16th, and we have a lot to talk about. January is the month when many people make resolutions for the coming year. I've made a few resolutions for this podcast, and since I'm going to need your help with some of them, I thought I'd share them with you. So I'll start with the big one. This year, I'm resolving to take Real Talk MS to the next level. Now, what does that mean? Well, to begin with, I'd like to accelerate the growth of our Real Talk MS listener community. Now, I'm incredibly proud of our numbers. You guys have made Real Talk MS the most listened to podcast in the MS community. Each week, this podcast reaches thousands of people in more than 100 countries around the world. But there are still hundreds of thousands of people affected by MS who don't know about Real Talk MS. And I think at least some of them might feel a little more encouraged and hopeful about the future if they had an opportunity to hear from so many of the experts that join me every week. So this is where I need your help, because there's nothing stronger than a personal recommendation. So if you're getting value from listening to this podcast, and you know someone who's affected by MS, I hope you'll do me a favor and share Real Talk MS with them. And leveling up doesn't stop with growing our listener community. I also want to deepen our level of engagement. If you're a regular listener, you've heard me describe this podcast as a conversation between us. And I always appreciate your emails, DMs, and for those of you who reach out on our listener hotline, I appreciate your voicemails. If you haven't heard about the Real Talk MS listener hotline, it's a phone line that you can call anytime to share feedback, ideas for future episodes, or anything else that might be on your mind. You can call the Real Talk MS listener hotline at area code 310-526-2283. And I'm taking a minute to remind you of all the ways you can connect with me, because I want to double down on our conversations. I'm inviting you to reach out in whatever way you find most convenient, and let me know what you'd like to hear more about in future episodes, or maybe there's someone in the MS community who you think would be a good interview. Whatever your suggestions might be, we're going to level up by making each of you a member of the Real Talk MS editorial board. And I'm really looking forward to hearing what you'd like to be hearing about in 2024. Some of you may have heard me say this before, but I think it's worth repeating. The things that people affected by MS want most: access to quality healthcare, affordable prescription medications, and funding for MS research. These are all things that are controlled by our legislators at the state and federal level. 2024 is an important election year in America, so as an MS activist, one of my resolutions is to report on those candidates, congressional candidates, as well as presidential candidates, who represent the best interests of people affected by MS. My intention is not to look at any candidate through a partisan lens. Instead, I'm going to focus 100% on their record when it comes to supporting healthcare legislation, research funding, and healthcare access. I think it's important to vote in your own best interest, to support the candidates that are going to support you. So I'm working on ways that will allow you to see how well a candidate for Congress or the presidency supports people affected by MS. My hope is that having that information will help you to be very intentional when it comes time to cast your vote. Leveling up Real Talk MS also means that you'll see more video content this year, you'll see a new website this year, and there's going to be one or two things unveiled this year that, for now, I'm keeping under wraps. I'm really not sure if I've come up with several resolutions for the new year, or if leveling up is just one big resolution with lots of moving parts. Either way, I'm hoping you'll play a part in sharing Real Talk MS on your social media channels and with the people that you know, and I'm looking forward to each of you connecting with me to share your feedback and suggestions for future podcast episodes. I guess you could say this is really all about leveling up our communication, which is exactly what I'll be discussing with my guest, Dr. Luis Manrique Trujillo, who's joining me to talk about improving your communication with your neurologist, MS specialist, or really any healthcare provider. It's not unusual to leave an appointment with a member of your MS care team feeling like you haven't been heard. It may be because there wasn't sufficient time. You might feel like your opinion isn't valued. It can even be language issues and cultural barriers that are getting in the way. Whatever the reason may be, Dr. Manrique is here to share specific tips and strategies that you can use to ensure that your voice will be heard when it comes to your MS treatment. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Manrique, there are a few other things that you should know about. Most everyone affected by MS knows that there is a genetic component to multiple sclerosis. Certain genetic profiles put some people at a higher risk of developing MS than others. But until the publication of 4 research papers this past week, scientists didn't understand where this genetic propensity for developing MS came from. Now they do. And it seems like that genetic predisposition for developing MS goes all the way back to ancient times and ancient human DNA. 175 international experts spent 5 years compiling the largest database of ancient DNA based on the bones and teeth of almost 5,000 humans who lived in Western Europe and Central Asia from 34,000 years ago until medieval times. Using this database, researchers were able to chart the spread and evolution of human genes and diseases as populations migrated and interbred. This analysis revealed how the transition from being hunter-gatherers to becoming farmers influenced certain genetic variants. And by comparing the ancient DNA with modern-day DNA, the researchers were able to gain a new understanding of some disorders and physical traits that humans experience today. So, with that introduction, here's the story of how humans became more susceptible to developing multiple sclerosis. The research team understood that as a group, Northern Europeans are among the most prone to developing MS. And to understand why, we have to go back 5,000 years when a tribe of nomadic herders called the Yamnaya migrated to Europe from an area that includes parts of Bulgaria, Romania, Moldova, Ukraine, Russia, and Kazakhstan. The Yamnaya introduced cattle and sheep to Europe, and they're believed to be the first humans to ride horses. When the Yamnaya moved westward, they had specific genetic variants in their DNA that researchers believe protected them from the diseases that were carried by their domesticated animals. As they interbred, these genetic variants may have been beneficial to European populations in making that transition from hunting and gathering to farming. Fast forward to today, when the protective benefits of those genetic variants are no longer useful. And as a result, these same genetic variants that at one time were protective are actually the genetic variants that make people more susceptible to developing MS. Now, if you're wondering about how this discovery accounts for the African American population and their relative propensity to develop MS, the research team found that African Americans whose genetic makeup placed them at higher risk for developing MS were also shown to have a higher percentage of this Northern European DNA. Now, if you'd like to review the details of what I found to be a fascinating study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. Just a couple of years ago, 2 large-scale studies provided conclusive evidence that MS is triggered by the Epstein-Barr virus, or EBV. Exactly how the Epstein-Barr virus leads to MS isn't yet understood. However, newly published results from a small study may bring scientists a step closer to solving that puzzle. A University of Texas research team analyzed the T-cells in the cerebrospinal fluid and blood of people who were newly diagnosed with MS, found that an unusually high percentage of these immune cells were specifically targeting EBV. As a quick review, T-cells are a type of immune cell that defends against viral infections. When the researchers looked at the top 1% of the most abundant T-cells in the cerebrospinal fluid, 47% of these cells were specific to EBV. And this abundance of T-cells that specifically target Epstein-Barr virus was very different from what they observed in other neurologic diseases, suggesting that it's unique to multiple sclerosis. Since this study involved people who were just being diagnosed with MS, the research team concluded that their findings strongly suggest that these T-cells are either causing MS or driving MS in some way, and they've already begun experiments to determine what that mechanism might be. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. I think we can agree that the price of MS disease-modifying therapies is unacceptably high. It's an issue that frustrates anyone having to pay a high deductible for their DMT. It's a problem that MS activists continue to address with our legislators. But it's hard to fix any kind of a problem until you fully understand it. And when it comes to the price you pay for your prescription medications, you just may be overlooking an important player in the pharmaceutical supply chain, and that's the Pharmacy Benefit Manager. Pharmacy Benefit Managers, or PBMs, are third-party administrators of prescription drug plans for insurance companies. These are the people who create the formularies, the list of approved drugs that an insurance plan or a Medicare Part D prescription drug plan will make available to consumers. Those formularies also determine how much out-of-pocket expense you and I will have to pay for a specific prescription medication. Of course, drug manufacturers want to make sure that their prescription drugs are included in these formularies. So the pharmacy benefit managers use that as leverage to negotiate deep discounts and rebates from the manufacturers. But no one knows how much these discounts and rebates are or where the money actually goes. Pharmaceutical companies tell us that the deep discounts they provide aren't getting through to the consumer. So until we shine a very bright light on the work that pharmacy benefit managers are doing, until we have real transparency in the entire prescription drug supply chain, we can't fix the problem because we can't see where the problem really is. The lack of transparency associated with pharmacy benefit managers is a problem. And the only thing that could make this problem any worse than it already is if different competing pharmacy benefit managers were illegally working together to fix prices. And that's exactly what's being alleged in a class action lawsuit that's been filed by several independent pharmacies against the pharmacy benefit manager Express Scripts. This lawsuit claims that Express Scripts teamed up with three rival PBMs to fix pharmaceutical reimbursement rates and fees and then collect a portion of that revenue. Pharmacy benefit managers control pricing and reimbursement fees for every prescription drug covered by every insurance plan. In fact, over the past few years, large insurance companies have paid billions of dollars to acquire pharmacy benefit managers. The plaintiffs in this lawsuit claim that this illegal anti-competitive practice represents hundreds of millions of dollars in wrongful overcharges. It's going to be interesting to see what happens next. I wouldn't be surprised to see Express Scripts, along with the other PBMs named in this lawsuit, offer huge financial settlements to settle the suit and avoid the bright light that this lawsuit will shine on their highly questionable and perhaps illegal practices. Hopefully, the plaintiffs will stay the course and follow through with their lawsuit. The outcome could be the biggest step toward reducing the cost of prescription drugs that the United States has ever seen. A step in the right direction when it comes to treating MS is making sure that your treatment plan is the result of shared decision-making. When a neurologist recommends a treatment plan that reflects their patient's goals, their level of risk tolerance, and other issues that can only be discovered through real two-way conversation. Unfortunately, that kind of conversation isn't happening in every neurologist's office. Joining me in a moment to offer strategies for improving the quality of communication with your neurologist or MS specialist is Dr. Luis Manrique Trujillo. Navigating the doctor-patient relationship as a true partnership requires mutual effort and open, honest communication. But communicating effectively with your healthcare provider and making informed decisions about your care can sometimes be challenging, and those challenges can quickly multiply when someone is faced with language or cultural barriers. Dr. Luis Manrique Trujillo is joining me today to discuss ways to enhance communication, bridge cultural gaps, and empower you to engage more effectively with your healthcare provider. Dr. Manrique Trujillo is a neurologist specializing in neuroimmunology and multiple sclerosis at MedStar Georgetown University Hospital in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Manrique.
Thank you for inviting me, John. It's a real pleasure to be here today.
I find that most situations in life benefit from clear and open communication. So when it comes to an upcoming appointment for your healthcare provider, what's the best way to prepare to ensure that all your concerns are heard and your expectations are met?
I would like to start by saying that you establish a long-term patient-physician relationship with the person that you're going to see for your MS, and you want to start that with the best terms possible. So that goes, the best way to make sure that happens is providing very accurate information, being open and very transparent about all of your health and in general your life with your provider. So the other thing that you can do to enhance this communication is probably being ready to participate with questions. And this also is helped by preparing ahead of time with a list of your concerns. To give you some examples about this open communication, if you are having a first encounter with the provider, you might start by telling them what's the reason why you're there, if you want to establish care with them because your primary care doctor sent you there, if you are looking for a second opinion regarding the diagnosis or treatments, or if you are transferring care from a different MS provider. The other thing that is very important is if you are in a follow-up appointment, is keeping in mind that MS brings so many symptoms and different issues, and it's going to be difficult to discuss all of them. So you can always prioritize what you want to talk about in terms of what has been most bothersome, and then you can schedule a second appointment maybe and talk about the other issues that you think are important. I think it's very good that you express to your provider what are your perceptions of the disease and what are the top values, because that will help them to understand and work with you to have a short and a long-term plan.
You know, MS symptoms and severity can differ from one individual to the next. So what's the best way for someone to live with the varied and unpredictable nature of MS? And I guess the flip side of that coin, how does a healthcare provider approach the many diverse aspects of multiple sclerosis?
That is a very important question, John. MS has so many different phases, so many issues and symptoms that can manifest throughout the course of this chronic disease that it can be very challenging even for the patients to pinpoint and see what's the most bothersome thing. So I will approach it in the following terms, probably addressing what's affecting your quality of life, which, you know, is very important to try to figure out what are those symptoms that are interrupting your ability to do those daily activities. You know, they might be episodic symptoms. Sometimes MS patients can have abnormal movements or abnormal spasms or cramps. We call it dyskinesia. And they only come, like, you know, once a day or so, but they can be very challenging if you're trying to finish, if you're at work, or if you're trying to sleep, or let's say, for instance, bladder symptoms, like if it is urgency that you need to run to a bathroom, it can lead to many different issues like insomnia. So you really need to focus and think about what those symptoms are really, really challenging your day. And that goes because sometimes we can think about symptoms that have been more chronic and more difficult to address. Like, let's say, cognitive issues is one of those that can be also very disabling, but it's more difficult to try to figure out what is causing your cognitive difficulties. But, you know, you need to really convey what is the group of symptoms that are the worst, and trying to communicate that with your provider. So the provider actually gets that information and try to make a plan going forward about how to treat those. We have different interventions depending on the symptoms that we need to prioritize, because we don't want to treat a symptom that is not as bothersome and then causing side effects and making your memory worse or your level of energy worse. So that's why it's so important to try to prioritize. And the way that I put it is like building that alliance with the provider, right? Like making sure that you are in the same page and learn what's important for you. And this might be a journey that you're going to take together. So both of you are going to learn about what's important during this conversation. So I think that's a good way to approach it.
Today, many people living with MS recognize that advocating on their own behalf is not only empowering, but it can lead to better outcomes for them. But self-advocacy can challenge what's always been considered the paternal nature of the traditional doctor-patient relationship. How can someone living with MS overcome those challenges and practice self-advocacy when they're discussing their MS care plan with a member of their care team?
So someone with MS can approach this self-advocacy by first making sure that they have someone they can trust as a provider, someone that they can talk to openly about their concerns, and then making sure that they communicate very well with them. I think that the other point that is essential is someone that is reachable. What that means is that you are able to reach them via message or in some way through the patient portals to make sure that they get the information about, you know, it could be new relapses or symptoms that have become more bothersome or anything that is happening to you. It's very important that that communication channel is available to the patient, and they might it might be work better if it is like a phone that they can call, or sometimes they can type or use the internet, or to give you an example, or if it is better for them to type or you know, let them know through the portal, then that might help them to self-advocate. I think that the technology nowadays is really helpful, and there are ways that you can let your provider know and showing them what symptoms you are suffering. I think that those are good ways to self-advocate.
Getting a second opinion about your treatment options sometimes makes sense, but I think there can be some hesitancy because a patient is worried that asking for a second opinion is going to have a negative impact on their relationship with their current doctor. Should that be a serious concern?
I think probably we can put it in the following terms. If you don't feel, or like if you feel like you need more answers than what you're getting from your provider, it's perfectly okay to have a second pair of eyes to take a look at you. This is a chronic condition. This is a disease that can affect you in so many ways that you want to make sure that you feel comfortable with the topic. It can even be to have a second educational session, or you might find new information with a second opinion. So the way I will go is that you shouldn't be afraid that your doctor is gonna take negative actions against you if you seek a second opinion. However, as we were mentioning before, transparency is key, so you should let them know ahead of time. They would probably like to know. And actually, in many instances, they may know the person that you're going to see as a second opinion, and then you are going to have a conference of doctors talking about your case. So it might be for the best. I think that that's the best way to approach that situation. I really advise patients that are seeing their local general neurologist to think about seeing an MS provider, even, you know, just to tell them, like, I was diagnosed with this important condition that it doesn't have to define who I am, but it's going to be there and I need to take care of it. So I just need a second pair of eyes. And I'll be very honest, John, we in the MS center, we see patients like that all the time, and we are perfectly fine with them if they want to continue seeing the local neurologist and then having us as a second set of eyes once a year or once every few years. And that's perfectly okay.
Well, you've just stressed how important open, honest, transparent communication is. When someone is talking with a member of their MS care team, what's the best way to make those conversations truly collaborative and ensure that their voice is heard so that all the elements of their treatment plan are truly the result of shared decision making?
Yes, I think that you may realize I was thinking about it, is you just mentioned that sometimes there is a paternalistic approach to have these conversations. And what that means is that the doctor will tell the patient what to do, and pretty much the patient needs to follow their recommendations. And then there is a patient-centered model that I think is ideal, because in that way, patients can practice active listening and questioning. And what that means is that they are going to be more interested in their health going forward. They're going to be part of the long-term plan. And that really helps all of us. Like the compliance with the medications, with therapies, is going to be really different if they are part of that team and then take a step towards shared decision making. And that's what patients need to keep in mind. I think that if you're feeling like your priorities are not being heard or are not being addressed, you might find yourself in a spot where there is a paternalistic relationship, and maybe you should propose, if you really like your provider, to switch it a little bit towards the patient-centered model. Or as we were mentioning before, sometimes it's better to have a second opinion and see how things are going.
Not everyone speaks English as their primary language. So for individuals for whom English is a second language, how can they best address potential communication barriers when they're speaking with members of their MS care team?
You're just touching one of the root causes of healthcare disparities. The minorities and immigrants really struggle with that. English as a second language is a significant barrier. You don't realize how important it is until you face it it doesn't have to be critical situations, but in the office where communication is so essential and you have a translator in between, it can be really challenging. So I completely get those patients that want to find someone that speaks their language. But I think it's important to understand that most of the institutions have a translator that they can provide, and they can actually have it virtually, which in my experience has been very challenging, because then you are going to have all of this breaking communication, and then the language, the body language communication is lost as well. Or you can actually request them to bring a translator inside the room that you're going to meet your provider. And usually that helps better. And I really think it's a good way to address it. It might be challenging for some patients to find a provider that speaks the same language. So I think that as we were, all the things that we mentioned before to improve communication come to the point that it's going to go through the translator. So you want to make it as plain and simple as possible, so we don't get lost in translation.
Well, we just talked about language barriers, but cultural differences can also create barriers to trust between people from different cultures. How can someone best establish trust with their healthcare provider in situations when cultural differences exist between them?
That's an excellent question. The cultural competency is one of our modern challenges as a healthcare system. I feel like we are not prepared, to build a cultural competence, and then as more and more is demanding from providers, sometimes we forget how important it is. And let's talk about the concept first. It is the ability to collaborate effectually with individuals from different cultures, and such competence actually is built over time from your experience, the time that you have shared with people from that culture. It's not something that you can easily learn from the TV or reading books, until you find someone and then you share different experiences with them. And you can get that from, as I was mentioning, spending time with them in the office or outside the office. But it's very important to understand that these cultural beliefs and values really drive many of the decisions that the patients take. And if you as a patient don't feel comfortable talking about these beliefs with your provider, you may need to find someone different who can have this competence and understanding better your condition, your disease is one step, but understanding who you are and what you believe might be as important. So it's very good that there are places that are working on that by, providing online resources and educating physicians. But there is a lot of work to be done, and that we need to improve.
Well, Dr. Luis Manrique Trujillo, thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks so much for talking with me today.
Thank you, John. I really appreciate you.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/333. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free RealTalk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of RealTalk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.